with the calculus of variations topic, and the plan is the following. So first, we're going to talk about Noether's theorem, which is related to conserved quantities. Then we'll consider continuous systems. So we'll study order Lagrange equations for continuous systems. Then we'll derive the law of conservation of the energy momentum tensor in continuous systems via Noether's method. And finally, if there is a little time, I'll just mention briefly about constrained variations. So this means that this means variations that are subject to some constraints. And you'll see in the tutorial in the afternoon one problem in which this is useful. You'll see at least one example. But again, this will be just a little bit at the end if there is time. So last time we derived the equations of motion, the order Lagrange equations for a system. However, in principle, they can be quite complicated, and it's not always easy to solve them. So a big simplification occurs when there are symmetries. And that's really the main reason the Lagrangian formulation is so useful, because it's very suitable to study symmetries and conservation laws. Now, what do I mean by symmetry? That means invariance of the action functional so I'll just use the notation that we used yesterday. The action is denoted by S, and Q are some set of generalized coordinates. So an invariance of the action under continuous transformations or variations of QI. So again, we're considering a system of, say, n generalized coordinates. System is described with n generalized coordinates. So symmetry is such an invariance. Now, there is a theorem called Noether's theorem that tells us that there is a relation between symmetries and conservation laws. So this is a very basic and very useful theorem. So it states that every symmetry of the action of some physical system implies a conservation law. And we'll see in a moment how that comes about. So in particular, conservation of energy or momentum are examples of such. And we are going to look at those examples more soon. So this is the basic statement. Now, to understand this statement, let's consider a small variation. Oh, sorry. Yeah, they are related one to one, indeed. But usually we describe a system with some action or Lagrangian, so we start from that, and we can prove that there is a conservation law. But conversely, if we observe in nature experimentally that something is conserved, then we are going to try to describe that system with an action that is invariant under the corresponding transformation. So to see what is the underlying reason, let's just consider a variation. So consider, since it's a continuous transformation, we are going to write it in its infinitesimal form. So continue, consider an infinitesimal or small variation. Variation and transformation here mean the same. Of the form Qi goes to Qi plus epsilon I. So this is small, which is the same as infinitesimal in this language. And also, epsilon I is a constant. So what that means is that it's a constant within the time interval that we study. But as before, at the boundaries, at the beginning and end, it vanishes. So we consider the same kinds of variations as yesterday that have vanishing boundary conditions. So the action, let me first remind you the general form from yesterday, the action functional, depending on all QIs, has the form integral from some. So here I'm not going to use indices t initial and t final, not to confuse with this index I that is just counting the number of Qs. So I'm going to call the initial time t1 and the final time t2. So again, I is counting the number of generalized coordinates. So integral of dt, and this is the Lagrangian, which is a function of t and qi dot. So that's where we ended last time, writing the action like this. And we also saw yesterday that the variation of the action under any transformation of the Qs, under any variation of the Qs, has the form t1 from t1 to t2 dt, and the functional derivative with respect to qi epsilon I. Epsilon I here is the delta Q from yesterday. So the reason to write this is just to point out that clearly when we consider solutions of the equations of motion, the equations of motion were the functional derivative equal to zero. So when we consider solutions of the equation of motion, the variation is just identically vanishing. So what I mean by symmetry, I mean that the action has to be invariant even when we do not consider solutions. So it has to be invariant regardless of what the Qs are, whether there are solutions or not, just for any Qs. So symmetry, so that's an important remark or not. Symmetry means that delta S equals zero for any Q, not just for solutions of the order Lagrange equations, not just for solutions . So in this lecture, I'll just abbreviate Euler Lagrange equations by EL so that I don't write it all the time, because I'll have to mention it a few times. So OK, so that's a symmetry. And we saw the action transforms in general like this. Now, go here. So to see that there is a conserved quantity that corresponds to this variation, let us make the following trick. So to see that there is a conserved quantity, and usually in physics, such a conserved quantity is called current, conserved current. Do the following. So let's first make the parameters epsilon I to be t dependent. So for now, this is just a trick, but we'll see in a moment why it's useful. So there we started with constant transformations. Now let's make them by hand to be t dependent. So in particular, that means that now we are considering, so it means consider variations qi of t plus epsilon I of t. So now that we have those variations, we can just compute what is the variation of the action. So for such variations, the variation of the action has to have the generic form. So let me first try this, and I'll say why. Actually, even before computing it, we know that it has to look like that, where j for now is just some quantity that we haven't specified yet. And here we have time derivative of those time-dependent delta q's. So this is the delta q from yesterday. So the variation has to have this form. So that delta s vanishes when epsilon I is constant. Okay, and here ji is just some as yet unspecified quantity, which will turn out to be this conserved current. That's why denoted by j, because in physics, usually currents are denoted by j. So if we consider a variation like this, and we know that when epsilon is constant, we have a symmetry, that means that the variation of the action has to have this general form. Yeah?
That would also satisfy.
Well, remember that we are only considering first derivatives in the action, so that all equations of motion contain at most second derivatives. So we never consider anything higher than first derivative at the level of the action. Okay. For more complicated functionals, thinking of other things, but again, for physical applications, we don't need second derivatives in the action ever. So, okay, so for now, this is just a generic statement that if for constant epsilon there is a symmetry, then when epsilon is not constant, the variation has to be proportional to the derivative. So that then when the derivative vanishes, this gives us vanishing action. Now, let's integrate by parts. So now, okay, this was step one, make the parameter time dependent. Now step two, integrate by parts. And sorry, I forgot to specify, that's the same as yesterday. So maybe I'll forget to specify it many other times today, but as always, the variation vanishes in the initial and final moments of time. This is always the case in these lectures. So integrate by parts, this generic form. So because the variation vanishes at the endpoints, we're just going to have that the variation of the action looks like, and that's why I put the minus there, right? At that level, J was unspecified, so there was no need to have a minus. It was just a convention. I chose it exactly so that it will drop out now after the integration by parts. So now we're going to have dt epsilon I multiplied by dji dt. And again, the boundary term dropped out because epsilon I vanishes at the endpoints of integration. So now, the third point of this procedure is to note that for solutions of the Euler Lagrange equations, so for QI solutions of the Euler Lagrange equations, the variation vanishes identically, as we know from yesterday. So therefore, when we have solutions, we have, so for a solution, we have a vanishing variation. But from there, we know that this equals, well, from here, to integral dt epsilon I dji dt. And the variations epsilon can be some arbitrary quantities. So from that, then, it follows that for solutions, dji dt vanishes. Or in other words, ji is constant. So this is the conserved quantity or conserved current. So this is the conservation law that is related to the symmetry that we started with. So any questions so far? The minus sign was just a convention. I didn't have to put any minus there because at that point, J was just some notation of some coefficient. So the main statement there was that delta S is proportional to the derivative of epsilon. And I just called the coefficient of that minus J. I could have called it J. But then after the partial integration, I would have ended up with an overall minus. So I started with minus J, so that then I would have delta S proportional to just plus. So for the moment, we just showed that there should exist some quantity. But in principle, that's also a procedure to compute it. So the steps 1, 2, and 3, they're actually a general procedure that is called the Noether method. For finding conserved quantities. So how does the procedure work? So if S is invariant under variation with some constant parameter, then first we make the parameter dependent on time, make epsilon t dependent. And compute the resulting variation. Of the action. So here I just denoted it by j, but in principle one can compute it. Once you have some explicit variation, you can compute the explicit variation of delta s that follows from that. So compute the resulting delta s, and then just read off the coefficient. We're actually going to see this, how this works for your energy momentum tensor. So this will become more concrete and hopefully more clear soon. So read off the coefficient in front of the derivative of this parameter. And this coefficient is the conserved quantity. So this is a very powerful method. For some symmetries, it seems like too much. But for most of the interesting symmetries, it's really an indispensable tool. So let me first give an example of a symmetry that can be seen in a very simple way to lead to momentum conservation. Any questions so far? So the simplest possible way that there could be a symmetry is actually if the action does not depend on some of the QIs, one or more. So the simplest example of symmetry is, symmetry under the transformation QI going to QI plus epsilon I. Is when, in fact, even when the Lagrangian itself does not depend on some QI. So in such a case, we have that DL dqi is equal to 0. And so then, the Euler-Lagrange equations imply, so remember the Euler-Lagrange equations were this term minus d dt of another term. So now we are left just with d dt of dl dqi dot equals 0. And we can introduce the notation. That's a standard notation, pi, for this quantity, dl dq dot I. And the derivative equals 0 means that this is constant. And we call this p because this is the momentum, the usual momentum. So that's momentum conservation. So this example is actually so simple that it's not clear why it would be useful to use this whole procedure. But I want to stress that this is really the most simple way to have a symmetry when the Lagrangian does not depend on one of the q's. However, in principle, most symmetries are such that they are due not to lack of a dependence, but rather to the fact that the different variations of different terms in the Lagrangian cancel with each other. So in the most generic cases, for gauge symmetries, for supersymmetry, for any kind of interesting symmetries, the Lagrangian depends on everything, but the various variations cancel each other, and that's why there's a symmetry. It's only in the very simplest cases when the symmetry is due to the fact that the Lagrangian does not depend on something. And of course, those simplest cases, because they're simplest, are most well known, like momentum conservation or energy conservation. And energy conservation would be related to the fact that the symmetry would be lack of explicit dependence of on time in the Lagrangian. But we're going to see that as a part of the energy momentum tensor conservation that I'll consider shortly. So I won't do that here. And it's anyway a bit more involved than this. So again, I want to stress that that general procedure is actually very, very valuable. Now let me turn to continuous systems. Any questions so far? Yeah?
How does the single example
fit in the logic? Yeah, like I said, I'll derive the conservation of the energy momentum tensor. And then you'll see how it fits, because both energy and momentum are part of the energy momentum tensor. So I'll show that explicitly. And you'll see then both will be contained in that derivation. But this is really the most trivial example, because it's the only thing that one can see directly immediately from the Euler-Lagrange equations. But generically, one has to use the procedure in order to obtain more interesting conservation laws. Yeah?
Thinking about conserved quantities and general relativity. So we have Killing vector fields. They generate isometries of space-time. So I was wondering if that is a special case of Noether's theorem because the metric because the Lagrangian is related to the metric.
Well, so generically, for example, if you have, yeah, so every symmetry is generated by some generator that is called Killing vector, mm-hmm. right? So for example, if you have some rotationally symmetric black hole, I mean, there's going to be angular momentum conservation that is related to this generator. So yeah, for more involved cases, it's more subtle. But every time you have some symmetry, you can find a quantity that's conserved.
Is it possible to do that derivation this way?
This is the universal derivation for everything.
Okay.
In special cases, there may be simpler ways, like in the case of the momentum. But this derivation works for anything always. It's the generic way to do things. When you don't know how to approach them, when there is no obvious simplification, that's the way to go. And it has been very useful, very powerful when studying supersymmetric theories, because in that case, you just have to follow the Noether method. It's not very clear otherwise how to show that there is a symmetry. So now let's turn to continuous systems. That's actually more interesting. That's why I'm going to show energy momentum conservation on that example at the end. It's more interesting, but it's pretty much the same like what we had until now, just that we're going to have, well, instead of just one time, we're going to have quantities, generalized coordinates that depend on both space and time. So things are going to be containing more variables and indices. So second point of the plan, continuous systems. So now we're going to have coordinates xi. Let's say the index I goes from 1 to d, where d is the dimension of space that we want to consider. So these are coordinates. In d-dimensional space. So if you prefer, you can just always think about d being equal to 3, so coordinates in three-dimensional space. But I want to be more general just in case, because there are, well, more general applications, not necessarily just to three-dimensional physical solid objects. So xi are d spatial coordinates, and we also still have the time coordinate. And now these are independent coordinates. X and t are independent coordinates. Like before, we were studying, for example, a position in space-time that was depending on t. Now that's not the case. These are just spatial coordinates and time coordinates. And the generalized coordinates now. So we're going to study a system that is characterized by generalized coordinates. Q, which depend on both the spatial and the time position, right? The momentum of time and the moment of time and the place in space. So let's see. Okay, so the Q that depends on both xi and t. And for example, in quantum field theory, this Q is going to be denoted phi. This could be usually some quantum field that depends on the position in spacetime. But of course, there are also various applications. Some you'll see in the tutorial in the afternoon in which this is not a quantum field, but some density of something or various other things. So the generalized coordinates are some generic descriptions of the system.
Generalized coordinates
not have indices? Well, for the moment, I've taken only one generalized coordinate. I could take also a set of them, but let's look for the moment just one for simplicity. But indeed, if you have several generalized coordinates, you're just going to put an index here, and you're going to consider a set of Euler Lagrange equations. So for now, for simplicity, I'm just considering one, and so I have only one Euler Lagrange equation. So the action that characterizes this system is really very similar to what we had before. But let's write it in this notation. So we have integral from some initial moment of time to some final moment of time, dt. And then integral over the space, the spatial variables. And let's call the region of space that our system occupies omega. And then there is some function that is usually like a curly L, denoted by curly L, which depends on the generalized coordinates and their derivatives. So their derivatives with respect to the spatial variables and with respect to time. And also could depend explicitly on the spatial and time position. OK, so let me write some notation. So this is clear, I guess. This is just dx1 times dx2 times up to dxd, the number of spatial coordinates. So omega is the region of space. Occupied by the system that we're studying. It could be the whole space-time if you study some quantum fields, say in that Minkowski space. What else? So djq, that is just a short notation for the derivative of q with respect to xj. right? Q is always a function of x, all of the x's and time. And the derivative with respect to xj, I'll just denote with a lower index j. Any other notation? Okay, and this quantity is called Lagrangian density. And so we have, as before, that the action can be written as just integral over time of the Lagrangian density, well, of a Lagrangian, which now is integral over space of the Lagrangian density. So we can integrate over the spatial variables the Lagrangian density, and that's the Lagrangian. And so just like before, the action becomes integral of the Lagrangian over time. And the boundaries of integration are always the same, even if I forget to write them, it's always the same interval. And we always integrate in the spatial coordinates in that spatial region, even without writing it. It's going to be self-understood. So now we want to consider variations. Of those generalized coordinates and see how the action varies. So consider variations Q of x vector just means the set of all xi's, right, for simplicity. So x vector, I'll sometimes use this notation, is the set of all xi's instead of writing that it depends on all of them. So the variation Q going to Q plus delta Q. With the conditions that, like before, the variation vanishes at the endpoints in the time integration, time 1, 2 equals 0, but also the additional condition that it vanishes at the boundary of the spatial region. And again, for quantum field theory in Minkowski space, this boundary would just be infinity. And that's the statement the variation goes to zero at infinity. So vanishes at the boundary for every moment of time. So I assume people are familiar with this notation, right? This is the boundary of omega. So these are now the fixed boundary conditions that we had before. Generalized to this case. So now we're going to write the variation of the action under those variations of Q. And this follows exactly the same steps that we did yesterday. So I'll be slightly briefer than yesterday. But it's exactly the same, just in this a bit more involved notation. So the variation of the action that follows from that variation of Q is the following. Integral from T1 to T2 dt integral over omega d dx. And now we have Taylor expanded in small variation. And so we have obtained here dl dq delta q plus sum over I dl d di q di delta q plus dl dq dot delta q dot. So this term is just the generalization of that, right? Here we have derivative with respect to time, and here is the derivative with respect to xi. So this arises exactly in the same way that that one arises, and it's summed over all I. So I'll start using again the convention, okay, from the next line of summing all repeated indices. So maybe this is the last time I write explicitly sum for those. So now again we integrate by parts. This is all repeating the steps from yesterday. So let me also write that. And use the boundary conditions that the variations vanish at the boundary. So this is the step now. So we integrate by part these two terms, right, in order to get rid of the derivative on the variation. And so we end up with integral from t1 to t2 dt integral over the region omega d dx. And now the integrand is dl dq. I'm going to take delta q outside of the whole bracket because after the partial integration, everything is multiplied just by delta q. So I'll just write the outcome after the partial integration, di dl d diq minus dt dl q dot, and the whole thing is multiplied now by the variation. Okay, so any questions? So this term again arose exactly in the same way that that term was arising yesterday, from partial integrating of this. So, and again, delta q is just some arbitrary variation. So then we see that this is the functional derivative here. So this is our delta s, delta q. So the Euler Lagrange equation is this. So the Euler Lagrange equation now is dl dq minus, let me also say that here I'm using the convention, so summation from now on, summation over all repeated indices will be understood. So the Euler Lagrange equation becomes, and let's write it like this, dl dq dot minus di dl d di q equals 0. And in fact, it's a very useful notation in principle for relativistic systems, but in particular quantum field theory, it's a very useful notation to combine the indices time and xi. So useful notation. To call just x mu the set of xi and t. So the index mu here runs over the spatial directions and the time. So this is useful for relativistic systems. And in particular, quantum field theory. So in this notation, then the order Lagrange equation acquires the form dl dq minus d mu dl d d mu. And people who do quantum field theory may have seen it in this form. This is really how it's always written. So, and again, d mu q just denotes the derivative of q with respect to x mu. So now we are ready to turn to the energy momentum tensor. Any questions so far?
In your expansion for the Lagrangian density, would that be a partial L by partial T?
Yeah, again, I mentioned in the beginning of the lecture, but maybe you forgot, so I don't know whether the confusing issue is that, for example, in one tutorial yesterday, we had this particle moving in electric and magnetic field, but in that case, X was the coordinates in space-time is dependent on Q, so the translation is like this. So from yesterday, we had xi's that were functions of t. Today, we call this qi. These are, qj, let's say. So these are the generalized coordinates. And yesterday, we had just time. And now we have time and xi. And these are independent of each other.
Yeah.
Here, x is not a function of t. This is not a trajectory in space-time. This is some other quantity that depends on the space-time moment. So these are independent here. So that's why here the derivative is partial with respect to time, whereas yesterday we wrote ddt full time derivative.
No, I mean, because you, from the Lagrangian density is dependent on time as well, right?
Yes, but we have that, right? We have both terms, derivative with respect to time and derivative with respect to xi. Or maybe I'm not understanding what you're asking.
Yesterday, non-continuous system. So we say this xi is generalized.
So actually, yesterday. I think in the lecture I was calling this y, probably not. But in one of the exercises, it was called x. So this will be a coordinate in space. And we studied a trajectory yesterday. We studied trajectories. So coordinates as dependent on time. Yeah, today we are more general. So today we consider time and space as independent, and we consider some other quantity that depends on the amount of time and the place in space.
But for yesterday's case, xj generalized.
But generalized coordinates could be also Cartesian coordinates, right? This was the first case that we considered. First, we studied Cartesian coordinates, and then we said that they don't have to be Cartesian. They could be some other quantities, and we introduced then the notation q for more generalized coordinates. But the Cartesian coordinates were the first example that we started with. So again, that's the translation from before x or y is now called q. And time, instead of time, we have time and xi that are independent coordinates in space-time.
Okay.
So today is going to be a longer lecture than yesterday, but I am going to finish. Since it's the last lecture, there is no way to let you go before I finish. Okay, so let's now consider the energy momentum tensor. Or rather, we are going to derive the energy momentum tensor and its conservation law from following the Noether procedure. So now let's consider an action of the form integral d equals 1 x. So here we're using this notation that xi and t are combined in x mu. So this is the d plus 1 space-time, right? Before d was just the space and time we kept explicitly. Now this whole thing is space-time, integral over space-time. And the Lagrangian density that depends on Q, the derivative of Q, and, So now let's consider this action. Namely, the important point is that the Lagrangian density does not depend explicitly on x mu. So as a result, L, the Lagrangian density, is invariant under transformations x mu going to x mu plus epsilon mu. And so we're going to derive now the conserved quantity that corresponds to that. So now let's use Noether's method. So first, I'll consider transformations x mu going to x mu plus epsilon mu, where epsilon itself depends now on the space-time coordinate. So this is the position in space-time. And as before, the variation vanishes on the boundary of the region that we consider. So this change in the coordinates implies the following change in the fields Q, or generalized coordinates. Q goes to Q of x mu plus. And now the delta Q is, since Q depends on x mu and we are changing x, so first we have dq dx, let's call this index mu. And then we have the variation of x. Okay, let's write it like this, which is actually this quantity epsilon. Right, so Q is a function of x. Under this change of x, then Q changes by first differentiating Q with respect to x, and then multiplying by the change in x. So the change in Q is Q plus d nu q times epsilon nu. And both q and epsilon depend on x. So OK, so that's now the change in q that we want to see how under this variation the action of delta s varies. Again, as before, the sum over the index mu that is repeated there is understood. So this is the summation over mu in the variation of q. So now let us actually compute the variation of s. Before, we just denoted it by j and said that it's conserved current. Now let's compute the variation that falls from that variation of q. So now we compute delta S. So we have delta S of Q equals integral d plus 1 x, again the whole spacetime. And then just following the same steps as above and as yesterday, we have the Lagrangian density differentiated with respect to q. And here is the change in q, which is now d mu q epsilon mu. Right? This is the generic delta q that we had before. Now the generic delta q has a particular form, plus dl d mu q d mu d mu q epsilon mu. And again, before, this was the generic d mu of delta q. And now we have substituted the concrete form of delta q. So for the moment, nothing really happened except we substituted in the generic expressions this particular delta q. So let's write this out. So let's take explicitly that derivative. So we have integral d plus 1 x. The first term is still the same. And then in the second term, we have dl d mu q And now we have one term that is second derivative of Q. Times epsilon mu plus another term in which the derivative acts on epsilon. So dl d mu q times d mu q d mu epsilon mu. So now we can actually express this term with the double derivative on Q in a simpler way by using the following. So let's call it for the moment term one, just for brevity. So can rewrite one in a nicer form. Due to the following.
See what I can
write here. Actually, I'll have to go on the other side. So we can rewrite the term with double derivative on Q in a simpler way, nicer way, because of the following. So we recall that the Lagrangian now depends only on Q and in UQ, not explicitly on X. No X, mu. So therefore, when we take a derivative of this Lagrangian with respect to X mu, this Lagrangian density, we have the following. So we have dl dq d mu q plus dl d, and I'll differentiate the second argument, times d mu q. So we see that this is the term with double derivatives. So we can express this term as this minus that. So, okay, let's also write that. So then we can write dl d mu q d mu q as d mu l minus dl d mu q. So substituting that in here, we find then that the variation of the action becomes. So then the variation of the action becomes. So we still have integral over the t plus one dimensional spacetime. And now we have d mu L epsilon mu plus dl d mu q d mu q d mu epsilon mu. And that's it. Now, notice that this happened because because we substitute that expression here. So this term is going to cancel with this term. Right? So we are left only with this expression. Is that clear, or do I have to write it explicitly? So yeah, so these terms are going to cancel each other once we substitute the simplified form of 1. So this is everything that is left. And now I want to rewrite this slightly. First let's partially integrate this term. Actually, we're almost finished with this. So this is going to give us integral d plus 1 x d mu l epsilon mu minus d nu d l d nu q d mu q epsilon mu. So again, there is no boundary term because of the vanishing boundary conditions for the variation. And now we can rewrite this slightly just so we have the same index on the two derivatives. So we can rewrite this as delta nu mu d nu of the Lagrangian density. Again, the goal is here to have the same index on the derivative, so I can take the derivative outside of the whole expression. So finally, we find integral d plus 1 x d nu l delta nu mu minus dl d mu q d mu q, and there is a still epsilon outside. So this whole quantity under the derivative we can denote t mu mu, and we see that we have integral d plus 1 x d nu t nu mu times epsilon mu. And again, it's arbitrary variation. So this is our conservation law. So the conservation law is d nu. So here I'm going up, but I want to stay on the same board. So this is the conservation law. And this tensor is called the energy momentum tensor. And this is the expression. Okay, so we're almost done. Let me say a few more words. So let me say in words what we found. So we found that the energy momentum tensor T nu mu is conserved due to invariance of the action. Of the action with respect to space-time translations. Because we started with some constant shifts of the coordinates that were coordinates in space and coordinates in time, coordinate x mu. So we started with some constant shifts, so these are translations, and we showed that the invariance with respect to that led to this conserved quantity that is known as the energy momentum tensor. And so this encompasses both the conservation of energy and conservation of momentum. So okay, that's all about this. Any questions about energy momentum conservation? Yeah?
So what we just derived shows that the energy momentum tensors divergences. But I don't think that having it divergences implies that you have a conservation law. I think there's an extra
condition. That is the conservation law.
I think there's an extra condition.
Meaning?
No, I have to look it up.
That is the conservation law. Well, in more complicated cases that are not really relevant for just perturbative field theory, you can have some boundary contributions and you have to redefine, say, what they mean by energy momentum tensor or reserved quantities. But in our cases, this is the conservation law. This is also like if you just study the conservation of some current, some say electric current, this is going to be divergence of the current equal to zero. That would be the conservation law, right? And in this case, the divergence is this derivative. And that's why actually those conserved quantities are called currents, because that's analogous to the conservation of electric current. So, okay, but in the last maybe 5 minutes, let me just briefly mention something about constraint variations, because like I said, you'll have a nice problem in the tutorial about that. So, yeah?
We derive this under the condition that the Lagrangian density does not depend.
Yeah.
Is that a general case or just one specific type of?
Well, what should I say? That is the Lagrangian density any time that you have invariance under space-time translations. Now, in Minkowski space, like the real world that we live in, there is invariance. But one can cook up more non-trivial examples, say in some instanton or soliton backgrounds in which some part of the space-time translations are broken, and so then there are more complicated things. But this is the generic thing that is true in four-dimensional quantum field theory. Perturbative. Yeah?
And why is it called energy momentum?
Oh, okay, sorry. Well, there isn't really any time, but because it contains these components, the energy
components
and the momentum.
The components are the energy and the momentum. Yeah.
Yeah.
The components
if
the
you write it, so this notation that I used is generically useful for any relativistic system.
Yeah.
But if you restrict yourself to some non-relativistic system that has then the energy momentum tensor would be, say, diagonal, if there are no other stresses, whatever.
Yeah.
And the time component will be the energy, and the three spatial components will be the three components of the momentum. So the energy momentum tensor just combines in one quantity energy and momentum.
So if the Lagrangian
well, I think the correct statement is that, yeah, okay, sometimes it's not, but other times you just have to redefine the conserved quantity. Again, it depends on what physical system you're considering, but other times it just means that the conserved quantity, well, is modified compared to what it would be just in a simple four-dimensional Minkowski space. So, but again, that depends on the context. So let me just briefly mention about constraint variations. Space. Okay. Let's make room here. Actually, I can still keep it for 10 minutes more, right?
Yeah.
But for example, in time-dependent backgrounds, energy is not conserved immediately. So if you have some more involved cosmological settings. And it's also important to remember that we were always looking at solutions of the equations of motion. So those conservation laws, again, apply on the classical solutions. So you know that at the quantum level, for example, there's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So energy conservation can be violated for very short moments of time, right? So that the uncertainty principle is satisfied. So this is all for now just on solutions of the equations of motion. So the final comment is about constrained variations. And also there could be quantum anomalies sometimes that break such conservation laws by some other quantities that appear instead of zero there. So this is really just like when you vary a function, when you want to find a minimum or a maximum of a function that is subject to some constraint. So let's say that we want to find stationary points, or that means extrema, of a functional. Now I'm going to go back to the math notation, because this is just a generic statement for any system. It doesn't have to be quantum field for anything. Say we have some functional J1 depending on some function y. And the integrand is f of y of x, y prime of x, and x dx. Now, we want to find stationary points of this functional. But the important thing is when some condition or constraint is satisfied. So when the condition say some other functional of the same function. So the integrand is some other expression g of the same y prime and x is equal, for example, to some constant. Let's call it c. So we want to find the stationary points of this functional, but such stationary points so that this quantity is a constant. That's the constraint. So what we do is, like I said, just in the case of functions and constraint variations there, so we introduce a Lagrange multiplier. So let's call the Lagrange multiplier lambda. And so then we consider, so, well, get a few more lines, so let me use a whole board. So we introduce a Lagrange multiplier, and instead of the original functional, now we look for stationary points of the following. Of the functional J1 minus lambda J2, which is so integral of f y prime x minus lambda g y prime x dx. So we extremize this, and now
once we find a solution, so a solution of the Euler Lagrange equations for this new functional, a solution of the Euler Lagrange equations will depend, of course, on lambda, because the functional depends on lambda. So how do we get rid of that? So let's call the solution y0, right? This is some particular function y, which is a stationary point of this functional. So to fix, to fix lambda, what we do, or how it's fixed by the condition that, let's write it like this. Lambda is fixed by So lambda is fixed by requiring that the constraint is satisfied. So the functional J2, the constraint was that this functional is constant, so that this is equal to C. So we first extremize this. We find some solution, which of course then depends on lambda. And then we plug it back in the constraint, and that fixes lambda. So that is also kind of the same thing that one can do for a function that one wants to minimize or maximize subject to some constraint. It's nothing really new here. Anyhow, so that's all I wanted to say. Any questions?
So in general, for the derivation of the energy momentum tensor and the conservation, it won't hold if you have finite boundaries, right?
If what?
If you have finite spatial and temporal boundaries.
Well, but we always consider the boundary conditions so the variations vanish on the boundaries. So then it will hold. But like I said, in more general cases, that doesn't have to be true. So then one has to take into account some boundary conditions and one has to see what happens on the boundary.
So the tensor being divergent doesn't always imply that it's conserved.
Can you say lower?
So the tensor being divergent doesn't always imply that it's conserved. Is that right?
So, yeah, so that conservation law we derived is true for the boundary conditions of the variation vanishes on the boundary. But again, when that's not true, there are contributions from the boundary. And there are physical situations like that, mostly yeah?
What I mean is because when you do the translation, then if you integrate your coordinate, I mean the limits of your integration will change, right?
Well, but the invariance is under constant translations.
Yeah.
So the differential doesn't depend on the constant translation parameter, right? The differential of the original and transformed coordinate is still the same.
So it's not. It doesn't depend on the fact that it's infinite space. I mean, the limits are infinite. Does that change if it's a finite boundary data space? Again?
Change the fields so that you have a new field near the reactor where the new point must be observed and that's the new open. So you change where the
So okay, yeah, I don't know, maybe we can discuss later whether I understood your question, but like I said, that conservation law is true for vanishing variations on the boundaries. Or at infinity if you consider the whole of space-time. So okay, again, that was all my lecture, sir. Finish now.